That's a great word. So let's. I'm hobbling because I'm getting old. We all are getting old. Let's. Lord, thank you for. Oh, Carol.
I just have one.
Sure.
I should have said it a couple of weeks ago when I stood up, but I just need to thank everybody for all the prayer that they've given me over the last couple of months and stuff, because it really works. I was going to stand up at church today, but I was too late to get my hand up and say that. And, you know, those who come alone, I'm one of them. I'm just sort of a single wife, you know, one of those days. And, you know, you need to get in, and you need to get into the small groups and places where people pray for you. And we'll talk to you and tell you the things that you need to hear. And I am just so thankful for this church. And Carol's talk today really hit home. And, of course, when she said, "Because he lives," that's the song that always makes me sob. Because it's true. It's because he lives. We can always face tomorrow. And I just really appreciate all of you and all of you, your prayers. Thank you. And I'm doing really great right now.
All right.
I know, because the lower dose, they put me on thyroid, that's perked me up like I can't believe. So, and I'm back on medicine, but it's really good. So thank you all. Be great.
Thanks. Cynthia, I think we know what we're singing the last time. So you got that. Father, thanks for the good report that Carol has, and for her great word, Lord, for us to be in fellowship with one another, even in difficult times. And then for Maria, thank you for her faith and her love for all those around her. We've said before, she's an example to us, and we pray specifically for Nancy, Lord. Perhaps we'll see her even next week. So thanks, Father. In Jesus' name, amen. Another person who's always great to see every week, Lambert Dolphin. Lambert, come on up and teach us this morning.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
We are looking at the life of Abraham in Genesis. It starts at chapter 12. Just if you'd like to just keep track in round numbers, we're 20 generations into the human race from the time of Adam, about 20. 10 generations before the flood, and then another 10 generations, and we get to Abraham. And a good, easy way to remember the time of Abraham would be to remember 2000 BC or 2200 BC approximately, or about 6,000 years ago. That would compute probably pretty correctly. And the text of the Bible spends quite a little bit of time about this man who is in the line of Shem. What's special? Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. What is the special about this family of Shem? What are their main calling in life, that whole tribe?
Religion
and spirituality. So and did God make any promises that he has to keep on down that might affect Shem? I'm thinking of a promise that God made to Adam and Eve, even especially to Eve, something about a seed. To Eve, the seed of the woman would be the Messiah of the world, would be the chosen seed. There has to come a male son in the woman's side of the human race, to Eve, who is the Messiah, the Savior of the world. And a counterpart of that is that there is a seed of the serpent, the bad guy, and he comes in opposition to the seed of the woman, and there's this war of the ages going on between the two of these. So that has to work itself out, and now we get down, it's time to start that story running again. And where did he live? Ur of the Chaldees, which is down in southern Iraq, not far from the Gulf, and it's a small little town, right? No, 50,000 books in the library, as I remember, 50,000 people, big, huge library, lots of pagan temples. And he had a department store that he ran in Ur. Is that correct? Abram's department. No, that was later on after Babylon that they all started department stores and so on. What did he do? He was a herdsman. So he had sheep, goats, cattle, camels, llamas. Well, sheep and goats primarily, but cattle probably. How big a extended family would he have had, do you think, if he had his sons and his daughters and his the extended family, and then he had a lot of workmen that sort of became part of the family?
A huge crowd.
Big crowd. More. Well, then let's see. How many sons did he have?
More than 30.
How many sons?
Three.
None. Daughters, none. How old is he? He's a young man, right? God calls only young people. You know, just, he's 75, has no children. But we get on a little bit later, we'll find today that he could round up 300 men among his workmen if he had something special for them to do. So that means that the contingent, the group of people that traveled with him, would have been 300, 400, 500 or more to take care of his animals. So they did not live in downtown Ur. They lived out on the suburbs, probably. Okay? Chapter 12 is about where the text emphasizes this man's life and calling. And he's a strong believer in Jehovah. Is that correct? He and his family are different than most of the people in Ur who are Chaldeans who worship the gods, Marduk and all the gods that Nimrod instituted in that part of the world. No, they're all unbelievers. He'd forgotten his heritage. It was all assimilated into the pagan gods. And the area now is fairly well populated. How long after the flood would this be, do you think? You can make wild guesses. 1,000 years, let's say. So the population of all of Iraq is built up, and they don't like each other, so it breaks up into tribes and groups, and they're hostile to each other. And the people who believe in God are very, very few and far between, and so it's very hard for them to unite together into any political entity or power. All right? And now God comes to him. And I don't know how God came to him the first time. Was it by email? Did he send a carrier pigeon in? There is a reference in the New Testament that says that the angel, that the Shekinah visited him. So maybe there was a vision of God. Remember, no Bibles laying around, no King James Bible. You can't tune into family radio and get the latest stuff, and you can't get all these junk sermons anymore that would tell you something about Jehovah. So God speaks to him in some kind of a way, and God says, here, get a pencil and tablet, get out your iPad, and because I have some notes. No? What's the message? First time God speaks to him is, pack up and leave. Get out of town. And now, probably if God said that to you, you'd be ridiculous. You couldn't possibly do that or wouldn't do it, or it's not the God that you've always heard about. But anyway, his father, who's quite a bit older, decides it might be a good time to move too. So they move. Where do they go? Well, God tells Abram to go quite a ways, a distance of X miles. The journey that he's supposed to go on is going to be X miles. X equals
600.
600. Yeah, that's good. A good guess. Up around the Euphrates River, over to the coast, which is now Israel. It's then called Palestine, and settle there. That's all. Just go. Now he hasn't had any maps. He doesn't have any picture guidebooks. There's no slideshows. He has no DVDs that can show him what it's like over there. He's just got to go. And that involves a considerable amount of trust if you've got all these people with you, this great crowd of people that depend on you for support. So he goes, the first move he makes, he and his family move north to Haran, a couple hundred miles up to the north of Iraq, and then they sit there. Sit there and sit there. Okay, what's the life of Abraham, is, as Steve already mentioned, is about faith. It's all about faith. If God speaks, you should act. So that's fine. He did exactly what God told him. Isn't that good enough? Well, you can't just act on faith once and get the goal. Get to the goal if the goal is Palestine. So God speaks to him again, and the second time he gets up and goes, and packs up and leaves. And God does give some sort of minimal promises. This is a covenant that God's making, a covenant. It's free. It's a series of blessings to this man that he didn't earn, doesn't deserve. And what is the first set of promises? Put this in modern English, and not in church language, if you can. Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you, and by him who curses you, I will curse. And by you, all the families of the earth shall bless themselves, or shall be blessed. It's nothing conditional in there. You do this and I'll do that. This is just, you take this one step and I'll do the following things for you. What does it mean that if God says to a guy like Abram, I'll make a great nation out of you? In that culture, in that time, I'm gonna give you offspring and a family with continuity, with integrity, with longevity, and come back down the road, and there'll be a whole nation that attributes its identity to you as the founder. The nations of the world originally had a patriarch behind them. And Abraham, if he's a reputable guy, is going to make a reputable nation, going to build a reputable nation. Okay? You're going to be a great, famous, godly nation then. All right? That's the I will make a nation out of you. And what about all this blessing? I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. And by you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Pretty good idea to hang out with Abraham, to get to know him, to be friends with him. Pretty, if you like to have God favor you. And not a good idea for you to treat this guy disrespectfully, or not to honor and pay attention, okay?
Goes for now, too.
I was just going to add that it's striking. It says, go forth from your country, then your relatives, and your father's house. Maybe you mentioned it last week when I stepped out, but he's leaving everything.
That's it. Pack up and go. Get out of town. And that's a pretty important, because it means leave your culture and your family values and the things you grew up with and all of the things that you believed in as a boy, that you were taught in school, all of the things that you thought were rock solid that probably aren't.
I was also going to say, Lambert, it's not only then, but now, he will bless those who bless you, and I will curse modern day.
Right down to the present. Right down to the present day. Now, is there a nation in the world today that owes its existence to Abraham that could be saved? That's the nation of Abraham.
Yeah. USA?
Is that a nation that whose forefather is Abraham? No.
But we are blessed.
Who is there a nation that we could, later on we can get the
nation of Israel.
Israel. I heard Israel. Israel is the nation that owes its identity to Abraham. However, that's not the whole story yet, because you need Romans 4. That's your homework. Be sure you memorize Romans 4 while we're in this section on Abraham, because in Romans 4, the question comes up, what is a Jew? Who is really a member of Israel? Because Israel is full of people who say that they're Jews, and Paul in Romans says, you are a Jew only if you have the same kind of faith that Abraham did. You got to have faith like Abraham had, and Abraham had a good connection with Jesus, and so if you say that you believe in God and you believe in Abraham, but you're not living it and acting it, then you're not a Jew. Therefore, most everybody in Israel right now is not a Jew by the biblical definition. But nevertheless, there's a remnant in Israel right now, few percent of people in Israel who are the true remnant. And what's going to happen to that nation that is barraged on all sides by people who want to wipe them out? The future, absolutely guaranteed. If you want to put your bets down, put them on true Israel. And what's going to happen to fake Israel? Well, they're going to get zapped like fake America. Okay. Now, so Abram, I want to move on here too. So you're going to have to do some of this at home and while driving in the car and so on. And, as long as you're not the driver. And he takes his nephew Lot along with him because Lot doesn't have a father alive anymore, and he takes his wife, and they go on, and they come into the land of Palestine. Now, there's something unusual about the land of Palestine that we won't find out until you read into the Bible a little bit. This land treats its inhabitants differently than any other piece of land treats its inhabitants. It's a little bit like Narnia. You go in there, and places are very special, and oak trees and hills have special significance, and then the Hebrew names generally mean something. And you don't just barge on into the land of Palestine and do whatever you please, because that land is owned by God, and he has chosen it for Abraham's descendants to live in. We'll see that in a little bit. So that's Abraham doesn't know that this land is going to be that. And God didn't promise at this point. He just said, you're going to be my people and a great nation. So he goes on into the land and sets up a monument to God, an altar. And then the first big problem comes up. Living in the land of Palestine is not to be problem-free, because right away there's a major problem in the terms of a big drought, a big famine. Big major famine. And the climate, remember, there is the Mediterranean dries like here. You have big drought years. And that's very serious when you've got thousands and thousands of goats and sheep and cattle, and you got to set up tents and you got to feed your families and you got to eat and so on. So what Abram does when he encounters this first major test is he gets the family together and he has a big prayer meeting. Is that correct? No, it's not. What does he do? He gets in the morning newspaper, he reads the Jerusalem Post, and he gets the Egyptian Gazette, and he gets the Kuwaiti Times, and then he looks and he says, oh, they seem to be doing really well over there in Egypt. Let's pack up and go to Egypt. So he packs up and goes down to Egypt, and sure enough, that problem is solved. It's lush over here, it's green, there's plenty of green grass.
I was going to say, I find that it just occurred to me after reading that many times. He goes to Egypt, but God never told him to go to Egypt to start with.
That's right.
A man-made decision, not a God.
That's exactly this. The first thing is, he's patting himself on the back because he obeyed God's command to go down to the promised land. He went there, everything's kosher, everything's fine, God's good. So he just puts it on autopilot and assumes that everything else that comes down the road is going to be good. But that's not how faith works. You've got to check the voice that's speaking to you and make sure it's God who's telling you. And if God isn't telling you to do something, don't do anything big. And there's a huge mistake then. And this would be walking by sight, not by faith. The usual dilemma that we have, walk by sight. It looks lush and green over there. It looks perfect for us, and he takes off and goes there. Wrong. Big mistake. Well, it's kind of humorous in here, because when he gets down to Egypt, he gets in big trouble with the Pharaoh right away. Why?
Almost immediately.
Well,
because he had a good looking wife.
Sarai, who is 100 years old or about almost, is a very attractive woman. There's nobody in here nearly 100, but you're all very attractive, but so I hope it lasts. And lasts. What happens? Quick summary.
He lies to the Pharaoh.
He pretends this big charade that that this woman, this beautiful woman, is his sister, and that would pass well. And the Pharaoh says, oh gosh, I can marry her, and puts her in the harem where she'll get special treatment. But the Pharaoh has very high moral values.
Actually, later on, we find out she sort of is his sister. Yes. So there's something to meditate on, the half-truth.
The half-truth, that's right. So Sarai is actually the half-sister of Abram. And so that's a half-truth. Isn't that good enough? No, it isn't. Half-truth is a half-lie. That's the problem here. So the Pharaoh is outraged when he finds out that this woman, he almost married her. God forbid, he almost married her and had sex with her, and then she would have had children, and they would have been the heirs to the promise. And that kind of would have destroyed the plan to have the Messiah of the world come down through the line of Abraham, if God had allowed that. Okay? So Pharaoh is outraged, throws the man out, get out of here, and sends along with him a little extra money, and which is kind of nice. Abraham seems to be getting richer all the whole time. And he sends him on out of the land and never get back. So they're not going to be good friends hereafter. In terms of typology, in terms of symbols of things, Palestine does not stand for heaven. Canaan. Entering Canaan land, in those old hymns, I cross the River Jordan and enter Canaan land. Canaan land stands for what in the spiritual life of a Christian? The life of faith. The life lived by faith and trust in Jesus. If you're going to live in the land of Canaan, then you've got to learn the laws of faith. Learn to not do things on your own initiative. Learn to trust God. Learn that this land is a dangerous place. It's bountiful, but the rules that apply elsewhere don't apply in the land of Canaan. The wilderness, then, the wilderness obviously stands for the life lived by self-effort. The Christian life lived in the effort of the flesh. And then Egypt stands for the world. The world with all of its glitter and show and all of the wealth and the longevity of systems down there. So all of these obvious historical geographical things are meaningful. All right. Now Abraham's right straight back where he came from in the promised land. I don't know how much time has gone by, maybe a year or so. And what happened to the famine? It went away. Just went away of its own. And had Abraham been a little wiser and prayed the first time around, then he probably would have avoided the consequences. Are there long-term consequences for that one mistake? Yes, there are. Turns out that when a believer makes a big boo-boo mistake, it's forgiven, it's reversed, the consequences go on and on and on. You send ripples out into time and eternity. Well, if you're just an ordinary, insignificant Christian, if there aren't any of those, but if you were, it wouldn't matter. But if you're going to be somebody important like Abraham, those little mistakes you made back there could have some very interesting consequences even today. All right. He's got a lot of money now, and his nephew Lot is with him, and they've got money. They can buy most anything that the local stores carry. I don't know what they had, Target, and I don't know who the stores were. Osh, I suppose you'd need fittings for your wagons and things. No, you wouldn't. You'd have to make everything by hand. And this whole land of Israel in Abraham's day would have been 100 miles long and maybe 50 miles wide or something like that. And it's fairly rocky, but it's very nice and lush in the springtime, a lot of grass. And it's very suitable for grazing sheep and goats. But now the problem is that Lot has got his family and his tents all lined up over here, and they're intermingling with Abraham, and these herdsmen who are just hired hands don't get along very well. Abraham, of course, would like all these hired hands and servants to come to know the God of Israel, but that's a long story. But Abraham and Lot have a little meeting about, we got to do something about the crowded situation. so many tents all over the hill, and many animals for this little piece of land. So Abraham says, let's split up. So what they do to split up is they cast Urim and Thummim, the two stones. I'm going to throw in some pretty crazy questions to see if other parts of the Bible have stuck in your mind. You should be yelling at me right now. Heretic, stop.
I thought the Urim and Thummim wasn't until Exodus. It's, Moses.
There you go. There's one man here that's passing the class. Okay. So Abraham says, okay, Lot, you take your first choice, and I'll take whatever's left over after that. And Lot says, wow, this is my day. This is my opportunity. All of my childhood dreams now.
Yeah. You know what? Ever since I've heard about the Urim and Thummim, you just sort of wonder about casting lots. You just sort of wonder when people are trying to make a decision you don't know, and you know, you flip a coin or something like that.
Yeah.
I suppose if the Lord leads you, I mean, this is not something he would go by. You can't say this is I go by, but I mean, you know, he can, but I would imagine he would prefer us to go by like peace, like he said, let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts in Colossians, you know, and counsel from others and all that. Sometimes it'll come down to
we'll take a four-week diversion and sidetrack and do a long study on the Urim and Thummim. Only trouble is that it'll have to be John will have to teach it. He's up to date on that. It's simply tossing dice or flipping a coin as a random process that is not, it's different than direct faith in God and what God's promised. So that's...
Well, I can add to that because I had some experience in business. When I prayed... make a major decision. Whenever I prayed to make a major decision, the consequences of that would all be positive. In other words, it would add significance to my bank account.
Uh-huh.
But when I failed to pray, that failure to pray also had consequences in the other direction. So I hope that might answer some.
We're here in studying Abraham. We're in the very kindergarten years of what faith is all about. We're learning just the basics. The basics so far would be leave your home and family and your culture and your background and go where God says to go and trust him and don't go off on any sidetracks and pay attention. And this is a lifelong commitment. That's sort of what we've learned. Because it doesn't say here, go read your Bible, because there isn't a Bible yet. All right? Now, where were we? We're going. We got out of Egypt. It's time to divide the land up. And so Lot looks all over the place. They're up on the hills looking over the land. And down at the base of the Dead Sea, below sea level, it's pretty well Salt Lake now. And a shallow Salt Lake at the south end and a deep Salt Lake at the north end and no living thing inside of it. But at the south end back in those days, it was well watered by freshwater streams and it was as lush as can be all year round. And Lot said, oh, I want that nice, well watered, lush piece of land down there by those five little small towns. A good choice, huh? You got your income, you got your monthly income, it's predictable. Is it going to sit there and grow grass all year round? It's peaceful and it looks just absolutely wonderful. Well, the people that live there are not exactly noteworthy citizens of God's country, but that's a detail.
Verse 12, though, there is that little phrase, and moved his tents as far as Sodom. It's sort of ominous that he crept maybe closer than he even needed to, right?
We get some little hints in here. The Bible puts a little hint in the text that we got more problems. For example, verse 13, now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. Very first mention of Sodom and Gomorrah doesn't say what it is they're up to, but it's not great sinners against the Lord. Earlier we had back in chapter 12, verse 6, at that time the Canaanites were in the land. That's just a little hint of trouble. Oh, Abraham, you're not the only guy living here in this land. There's some people called the Canaanites. The next time the Canaanites are mentioned, we throw in the word parasites. Just a little bit of an introduction that it's not all friendly here in the land. But we'll get to those things and we'll deal with them as we come to them. All right, so Lot gets to choose this nice, wonderful piece of ground. He descends. They're probably up there. If you get a nice map or a topographical map of Israel, you'll see that if you go up west of the Dead Sea and you come up to that range of hills, 2,500 feet high, you can look down over that whole area. And if you look west, you'll look over towards the Mediterranean. And so you get a lay of the whole land view from up that way. So the settling is good. Now, verse 14, the Lord said to Abram, chapter 13, 14, after Lot had separated from him. That's key, important. After Lot had separated, after this transaction had been agreed upon, lift up your eyes. God said to Abram, lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, north and south and east and west, for all the land which you see I will give to you and to your descendants forever. I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone count the dust of the earth, your descendants also shall be counted. Arise, walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I will give it to you. So Abram moved his tent and came and dwell by the oaks of Mamre. Mamre means fellowship, which are at Hebron, and there will be an altar to the Lord. All right, now, is there something important about Abraham and Lot separating that's a spiritual principle? Doesn't matter, it's arbitrary.
Well, he's separating them from the pagan, his pagan background. Because if Canaan is starting a life of faith, then Abram is now starting that. And he was told in the beginning to leave his father's household, yeah, and his land and his people.
Yeah, and now he's going back to something more pagan.
He needs to separate from him too in order to be...
Right, good, okay.
Lot is worldly and Abraham is spiritual.
Carnal and spiritual. Do Christians, do believers today divide into two classes, carnal and spiritual?
Yes.
You wouldn't know it because in this class there are no carnal believers. So we did a survey and everybody filled out the form. So in real life we have people that are believers but don't take their faith very seriously, compromising. Particularly when it comes to finances and business and things that would work to your own advantage that might be not as desirable for God.
When you mentioned spiritual principle, I just kind of took a quantum leap several centuries forward and thought, Abraham is really practicing what we call the golden rule when Jesus gave that instruction to do unto others as you have them do unto you. And it strikes me that Abraham, if he were given a choice, you know, he might have even chosen the hill country.
Yes.
But the principle I see is, if Abraham said, I'd like someone to let me have my choice, so he practices giving the choice away.
Yes.
He gives it to his nephew. Even though Abraham was entitled to the choice, I think it's reasonable for me.
And
you take your choice.
And what does Abraham end up owning? Everything, including Lot's property too. Yes, it's God's kind of humor and.
Yeah, I was going to say that they couldn't be under the same law. Lot and Abraham couldn't be under the same yoke.
Did you? Okay, was that a comment or?
Yeah, that was a comment.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Oh,
How do you know that it's not spiritual?
How do you know what is spiritual and what is carnal?
Lot.
Lot.
His name
actually
Lot. Means.
How do you know?
How do I know that Lot is not a spiritual believer? That's a great question.
I recall in the New Testament, Lot is referred to briefly as, I think there's a passage that says, what if righteous Lot?
Yeah. We're going to get some references to Lot in the New Testament.
Some reference to him as being righteous and separating himself from Sodom just before the judgment of Sodom.
Yeah, I think you piece this together a little by little by places elsewhere in the Bible, including the New Testament, as I just assumed it jumped here.
To me, Lot is sort of an example of somebody who is a believer, but who's making not the best choices,
yes.
I think, and then suffering some of the consequences. And I think we all can relate to the fact that we know we're saved, but we've all made choices that, as you said, have consequences that ripple on. And so I think they both harmonize, but I think he's made some bad
choice.
Decisions.
Now, a carnal believer could change his course in life at any point and just say, hey, I've been messing up bad, I'm going to stop right now. That we hope that happens. Now, First Corinthians is where Paul, I think, talks to the Corinthian church about the issues of carnality and spirituality in that congregation. But I don't want to get sidetracked on that.
Just one quick final comment on Lot. I believe it's in Hebrews where it says that he was righteous and that actually living in Sodom vexed his righteous soul.
Yes, he was a believer. Lot was in fact a believer.
Wanted things that probably weren't the will of God for him to have.
Can you imagine living in a neighborhood full of pornographic stores and houses of prostitution and you're the only one that is a moral person there, that you might have a vexed soul as these people came and went in your shoddy, sleazy neighborhood? It might vex you a little. I would hope so. Now,
if we're talking about principles here, what principle was Abraham serving when he went to Egypt and when he told the Pharaoh that Sarah was his wife?
That's great. That's a good question. So I just have just made Abraham look like a great hero and a champ, and Lot's the bad guy. So
I just wanted to mention for the person that was asking about the carnal, the natural, and you mentioned 1 Corinthians. That's in 1 Corinthians 2 and then 14, 15, and 16.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So spiritual Christians do occasionally make bad choices? Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, big time.
Big time.
Big time. And more than once. Abraham's going to repeat his Egypt's bad choice here again a little bit. So, and so God has, there's some, when God says, notice that God has expanded the original promise. Now here in chapter 13, verse 13. The land, if you were unsure of the borders, here, let me tell you where the borders go. And let me confirm that this land belongs to you and your descendants forever. And not only that, there's going to be so many people that are descended from you that they... there would be as numerous as grains of dust or grains of sand on the seashore. Can't be counted. And everywhere that you walk, you've got a long life, so you're going to walk all over the place, and every place you put your foot down, that just kind of confirms that that land is yours forever. And so Abraham just settles down. In the meantime, while he's waiting for God, he settles down at the Oaks of Mamre at Hebron. Hebron's where the tombs of Abraham and the patriarchs are to this day. The place of fellowship at Hebron. What is happening every time God speaks to Abraham? Every time that God speaks, Abraham acts.
Builds an altar.
he builds an altar, he does what he's told, and then God speaks to him again, and next time, when you obey God, he gives you more light. Abraham getting more information now. Didn't have much to go on when he left Ur. Just had a little, just get out of town and go over there to the coast, and that's about all. And I'll tell you later, and you trust me. And he gets over, the next time he's asked to obey, he obeys. And every time you obey God, you'll get more light. And God will say, now let me just explain a little bit why I had you move over here. And that's how faith works. Faith trusts in what God has said is true and acts on that. At any point along the line, you could just say, I've had enough. I think I'll settle in this. And I have a little cottage in Milpitas with a houseboat and down at the sewage outlet at the bay. And I think that's enough. I've had a great life of faith. I'm just going to retire here and fish. Is that okay? Is that don't eat the fish? Would that be a life of faith? No. You got to finish. You got to keep going until the day that you keel over, drop dead, right? You may not be as vigorous then, but okay, is that clear? That faith. Now, when is Abraham saved? To use that Sunday school New Testament word, when does Abraham get saved in this process? When he dies, you could say he's saved at the time he dies. Is he saved when he leaves Ur of the Chaldees? I don't know. Is he saved when he takes the next step and obeys God? Well, every time you see the step of faith, it's a very good sign. Right? Yeah, yes, he probably is saved the very first time that he leaves Ur.
Remember?
Yeah.
In these days, this was before Christ, so how could there be salvation?
Oh, there's a good question. How could... Oh, we should be talking about something other than salvation. Well, salvation is conceived of differently in the Old Testament here among these nomadic peoples. It has a different meaning, but... This is good. Indeed, this is a place. It's very important as a New Testament believer to think through how your faith sheds light back on Abraham.
I think the way I think of it is that history is a pinnacle. We look back to the cross. They look forward to the cross. And Jesus himself said in John, I think it was, Abraham longed to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. So he was saved.
He was.
But without all the details that we have looking back.
Yeah, and we have that statement that he didn't care at all about the piece of land that God had given him, but he was looking for a city which is to come, which the builder and maker is God. So he was pretty shrewd. And then he and Jesus had fellowship together in the spiritual world. So he's a smart guy. He knew more than he talked about. But the whole idea about true faith is carrying on, going on. Putting your faith and trust in God and stepping forward. Now, faith gets easier and easier the longer you've been a believer. Is that true? No, it's not. Well, that's not fair. Shouldn't it be easier all the time?
Some days are.
Okay.
Get Abraham visited the tabernacle.
Did Abraham visit the tabernacle at this time? There was no tabernacle at this time, except the one in heaven that hadn't been made known. So that's a good question. Didn't exist yet. No synagogues, no churches, no Seventh-day Adventists, no Mormons, no... I was hoping we could... what do we have until noon? Or
yeah. Go till about 5.
I was just saying that this instance sort of makes me think of the fact that, you know, Jesus isn't returning again until the whole world knows about him. But how did people in the Old Testament, they learned from God spoke to them in their minds or in visions or in dreams and stuff like that. And I presume he still does it today in places where missionaries haven't been.
Yeah, Romans 1 is that all men are without excuse, that all men have enough knowledge about the existence of God to believe in him, and then nobody has an excuse. So that's all ages and all. Once Jesus had died on the cross, that the ripples of that event go into eternity past and forward, and the work of the cross is predated back to creation. So Abraham gets in, and Adam and Eve get in, and everything. Let's get at 14 if we could. We need to get through Genesis by Christmas here or something. In the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim, these kings made war with Bera, the king of Sodom, with Bersha, the king of Gomorrah, with Shinab, the king of Adma, with Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is, Zoar. All these joined forces in the valley of Siddim, that is, the Salt Sea, Dead Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, but in the 13th day they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and subdued the Rephaim in Ashtaroth Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Enim in Shavath Kiriathim, and the Horites in the mount in their Mount Seir, as far as El Paran on the border of the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to Enmishpat, that is Kadesh, and subdued all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who dwelt in Hazon Tamar, the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Adma, that is the king of Zeboim, the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out. And they joined battle in the valley of Siddim with Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, 4 kings against 5. The valley of Siddim was full of bitumen pits, and all the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. Some fell into them, and the rest fled to the country, the mountain. So the enemy took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. Now, what in the world is that doing in there? We're having this nice little discussion about Abram and his quiet little life, and suddenly, well, we're getting a little history. This history is known from archaeology now. It's documented, these guys named here. Remember that after the flood, the population's building up in the Tigris-Euphrates valleys, and nobody likes each other, so they're all splitting up and starting little city-states, and you see these founding fathers, these are all bad guys. These patriarchs are all bad guys. So they're all going to have little hostile feudal gangs fighting with each other. The chief of these guys at the time is Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, and we know that his piece of Iran is down by the Gulf Coast. And some of these other people we know from a map of that region.
About how long was this after Lot and Abram split?
I don't know. I have no idea. If anybody has any clues as to how long this was after Lot separated from Abram, that you can bring some comments next week and enrich us. All right, there's always warring going on between these city-states over that are in Iran. Some bad guys are all out for territory, and these feudal disputes flow over towards Palestine. And this particular feud going on runs all the way over to Sodom and Gomorrah, and the feudal kings come in and take over Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain and take captive Lot. So what? Happens all the time over there. It goes on all the time. There's only one reason why you'd ever bother to get involved with these bad guys would be for Lot's sake. Why not just let Lot sit down there and suffer the consequences of him living there in the first place? Wouldn't that be just normal? Yeah, it would be. But Abraham isn't that kind of a guy. He has no hope. He doesn't have any faith in God. He hasn't got any other believers living down there with him. And he's living in this thoroughly pagan city that God could just as well destroy any time.
Yeah, I don't think, especially in those days, that you would let anybody mess with your relatives.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, you don't mess with Texas and you don't mess with Abraham.
That's
right. You're messing with Abraham.
That's good. Now, while this commotion is going on, it says in verse 13, one who had escaped came up over the hills and told Abram the Hebrew who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite brother of Eshcol and Anar, who were allies of Abram. Living with Abraham are some individuals who are strong allies of Abram and ready to help him and ready to go to battle with him. When Abram,
I have a question. It says Abram the Hebrew. Is that the first time the word Hebrew? And so what does Hebrew translate at that point in time?
Oh, I forgot too, and I just saw it too. Oh, we'll have to look that up. Oh, Randy knows.
It was Abram. I think we said last week that it was derived from Abair, who's in the family.
Yeah, but do you know what the name means in English?
What it means? No, I don't.
And I keep saying Abraham here, but it's this point in the text is Abram, because Abram gets his name changed a little later on, and that's important. Okay, so then somebody escapes from this battle and comes and tells Abram, and Abram's sitting out there in front of his tent with these men who are kind of like foremen or co-workers. And so Abraham appoints a little army of 318 men and went in pursuit as far as Dan. And he divided his forces against them by night. Where's Dan, by the way? The absolute far north of Israel. And what in the world does Dan mean?
Justice.
Justice or judgment. So this Abraham does get involved. It's ridiculous. He only takes 318 men. That's absurd. He's going to be slaughtered, obviously. That's not going to go well with Abram, obviously, right? And so they're going to go solve this whole situation by taking 318 of their forces, of Abram's allies, and going up way north. He divided his forces against them by night, Abram did. So he's dividing the 318 up and routed them and pursued them to Hobah north of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods and brought back the kinsman, his kinsman Lot with his goods and the women and the people. So this little band of 318 men, backed by the power of God, the God of Abram, runs up and routs all these bad guys and sends them scattering and takes Lot and all the possessions that these bad guys have stolen from Sodom and Gomorrah, takes them back. And after his return from the defeat of Chaolaomar and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shavah, that is, the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abraham by God Most High, maker of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High who has delivered your enemies into your hand." When we come back and start on this next week, it's pretty interesting. And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. Abram gave Melchizedek a tenth of everything. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself." And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, "I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, maker of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal thong or anything that is yours, lest you should say, 'I have made Abram rich.' I will take nothing but what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me. Let Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre take their share." Okay, now there's a lot there. There's this incredible military clash involving these thoroughly trained, skilled in warfare tribes that fight all the time anyway, I don't know how many of them are. Maybe some of you would go do a census, Google on these guys and find out how big how big their army reasonably was. You probably could do that. And let us know next week. They're fighting each other all the time, and Abram sits there, probably has a little prayer meeting with his three friends. And he doesn't get terribly upset about it. He just sits there and says, well, Lord, what are we going to do? We want to get minimum. We want to get Lot back. Maybe he sent a telex. Oh, my goodness. That's way out of date. An email. sent an email down to Lot in the field and said, why don't you come and stay here in Hebron right now? Life here is pretty good. Or do you really want to go back to Sodom? Because if you really want to go back to Sodom, it's your choice and we'll put you back there. But this would be a good time for you to move. We got a lot of other land. And so Lot evidently made his choice to continue staying there. And good old Lot, which we'll talk more about later. So Abraham, with 318 men, quickly, by God's strategy, routs these armies. They don't like each other anyway, and scatters and pits them one against another and sends them running out of town. I wish we knew more about this. Probably very exciting how God did this. No big deal for Abraham, no big deal for faith to do something this big. I don't see any mention here of casualties. I don't think Abraham lost anybody, whereas I do suspect these other kings probably had pretty big casualty list. Then the battle's all over and they have a little meeting in Salem, a little town called Salem. Current name of the little town?
Jerusalem.
And it's a pagan city, it's a Canaanite city. And lo and behold, they don't have a synagogue, they don't have a temple, they don't have anything like that, but they do have a king and a priest who is priest of the Most High, and he's also king of Salem, and he is a man of God. And now that's unheard of. That's just doesn't make any sense at all, and so the Bible's silent on that. Makes people wrestle over who the guy was for a long, long time. And so next week, let's talk a lot about all this. And Melchizedek turns out to be a very key man in the Bible, about which we know next to nothing. And he figures very much into the role that Jesus has as king and priest in the days to come. And we find something about Abraham, because as far as we know at this point in time, Abraham is the biggest honcho in the world as far as God's concerned. He is the man of faith. Now, there are probably other believers scattered out around the world, but Abraham's in the Bible and he's getting a lot of press right here. So he's evidently, as far as God's concerned, an important long-term character. And if he's going to be the father of Israel, it's a big deal. And then we'll find out our connection to him is that we're all his sons and daughters because of our faith in Jesus. So this story amplifies a lot. Now, I guess, Steve, would you like to pray and set me straight on all my...
We'll sing and then we'll pray.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
We'll
yeah.
sing and then we'll set you straight.
Okay. Thank you.
Actually, I can't do that. But I do think that Lot moved near Sodom because there were more stores.
Yeah.
His wife wanted to shop. Which shows you why you don't need to compromise about things like that. You don't want to move closer to shopping. Okay, 213. Because he lives. Thanks for choosing our beautiful song today.
God sent his son, they called him Jesus. He came to love, heal and forgive. He lived and died to buy my pardon. An empty grave is there to prove my Savior lives. Because he lives, I can face tomorrow. Because he lives, all fear is gone. Because I know.
I get the impression, maybe I heard it someplace, that most of the gold in those days came from the Upper Nile River.
Yes,
mined, and they come down into Egypt. And these people.
Well, that would have, of course, that could have been a little later. They would have had the gold, a lot of gold over through here. I don't think Egypt got settled much before 2500 BC. The temple gold. I wrote an article on the temple gold, many tons, and it was mostly donated to the temple in Jerusalem.
They would come out of Egypt when the Exodus went, didn't it? They gave them a lot of gold.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. I would have thought there could have been gold in China and India.
Gold is said to be immutable.
Yeah.
Nobody throws it away.
No.
I mean, it gets recycled all the time.
It gets broken down and turned back into powder, I think.
We throw some up into space.
Yeah, we do. Was this okay today? Am I too flamboyant, too sarcastic? Am I being too sarcastic with my...
No, I don't think so.
There's lots of things that... I follow in my weird mind and becoming useful talking to others. So I did a little Chaldean research.
Oh, yeah.
Oriental supply hardware. So probably spot on.
Oriental Supply Hardware. Osh.
Excellent today, as always, thank you.
Osh. Did you hear that?
I was thinking about it when he mentioned it.
Osh Hardware.
Ben.
There we go.
Thank you, Steve.
Jack works at Osh.
Oh, well, let's have some gold.
Jack has a little prompted ministry. A couple of years ago, we used to make coffee together. He says, an old boy, thank you, or something. This old guy told him how old he was. And Jack, they were just talking, and the old boy said, he was just chasing the bells and all this old friends and all the rest of it. Jack played the gospel. The guy was just like out of the store. Most people are up here now again.
Well, good to see you, sir.
How do you do? Good to see you. Have I given you back everything you've loaned me?
Oh, yes.
Books.
Yes.
Money. Thousands of dollars.
Thousands and thousands.
I guess I could pray, General. I could pray some more blessings.
You know, I think about you often.
You're very kind. You guys, your prayers is what kept me going.
And then I just look forward to some time we can just sit down and you can just talk and tell me about what is and what is to be.
I want to hear the same from you.
He can moderate. I was scrambling around, going through help pages in here to try to get more of a sense of the geography. Because I don't know where all those guys came from. But Turtle Omer, he came from the area of Earth.
So, yeah.
And there was no interstate going east and west.
That's right. So it all comes along
the Crescent. You know, Abraham went this way in the Fertile Crescent. He went back that way, or he came that way, but he was headed that way. And I thought, strategically, my assumption is, because of the little I do know of the geography, which is not much, is that Chettle Omer and those other guys, they're people of the plains.
Yes.
Abraham, because he let Lot have his choice. Lot was in the plain, but Abraham was from the hill country. Those guys knew how to fight.
They knew
how to do guerrilla warfare.
Yeah.
You know, wasn't it a bunch of... And they were going after... There might have been a lot more people, but they were a bunch of desert rats that didn't know a whole lot about fighting in the hill country. And north of Damascus, that's just kind of the border of hill... And I don't know exactly the place north of Damascus where they encountered each other, but that might have still been hill country. That's not a big determining factor, but it's just kind of interesting.
The U.S. military academies use the battles of the Old Testament in their warfare classes.
And Israeli defense force.
Yeah.
Same.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, they're referring to Dan, but Dan doesn't exist yet, right? Is this a reference to a future known area?
Uh-huh.
So, because there was no Dan yet.
That's right.
Dan named after the region.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Dan didn't... Dan was up there illegally too, because they were their allotment was down by Judah along the coast, and they didn't like that, so they went up and took.
Didn't Dan split?
Illegally, they went up there.
Like North Dakota and South Dakota.
They went up to they liked the area to the north, so they just killed all the people there and went up and took over.
And he grabbed it.
Oh. Yeah, because I'd blow up if I go out the door with this.
Yeah, that's right. I set it up that way so you can't get too far.
I know. I heard it beeping, so. Okay. Well, it's another nice day. Well, we got a lot to talk about, you and me.
Just something that... nobody else I've ever heard about or talked to. I think that we, the Christian men, Christian people, we are we haven't even come close to attaining the development of the world.
I know. Yeah.
I mean, right now, and we haven't even. I not too long ago, the Lord gave me kind of sort of a glimpse of how much we are able to do. We are able to do, and yet we are. How can I say? We aren't. I hate to use the word claiming it, because it's kind of sort of got a negative connotation nowadays. But we aren't availing ourselves of what is there.
That's true. Well, I think we're very compromised by the world, and we sit, stand in awe of the world's accomplishments, and we're afraid to do anything like that. You know, we're easily intimidated by the pagans, I think.
The glimpse that he gave me was almost, for me, it was breathtaking. I was just, and then it was gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's just,
this was a glimpse of
how great we are. And right now,
yeah. I think that's true, because if we live in either in the past or we live in the future, then we're not much good for God. And we usually are. We're usually stewing over something that went wrong yesterday, or on the other hand, life is terrible now, so I can't wait to go to heaven. Then it'll all be good.
Yeah. That's
meantime, I don't have anything to be thankful for, so I'll just grumble.
Like the rest of us, huh?
Like the rest of us, yeah.
You know, there was that question, how was Abraham saved? And chapter 15, verse 6 says, Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness.
Yeah.
Isn't that how we get the same thing?
It's interesting that promise doesn't show up till well along the way, until he's had all these others. It almost suggests like... The record books wait until you have practiced your faith quite a little while until your name gets put down. It's profession of faith or show doesn't count for anything, and it may be that.
How could Paul say that my salvation was chosen by God before the foundation of the world, before Genesis? Paul knew, God knew Paul and selected him, chose him, gave him a future as Paul the Apostle to the Gentiles.
Yeah.
Okay, now there are other places in the scripture where it says we also have been chosen by God, and God has the right to choose whom he will.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is, I don't think people come accidentally.
Yeah. He can outrun us, I guess.
Isn't this rather Calvinistic?
Yeah. Both. Mm-hmm. It is.
But that leaves us kind of sort of without any well, anything that we can add, or not add, but anything that we can be other than what has been decided that we are.
Already are, yeah. Absolutely. It's a wonderful class. This is the greatest bunch of people in here.
A lot of give and take, yeah.
Yeah, and cream of the crop from PVC. That, and the group before us, these roadrunners or whoever they are, they're a pretty neat bunch of newcomers. And it's nice to see another generation
coming up.
Yeah, I think that's the new generation of the new PVC, of the
the new crop.
The new crop. I don't think that, there's a new crop coming out of the old church, old PBC very much, to speak of. Times is changing. Okay. I think I will.
Praise God.
This was a good day. Mm-hmm. For some reason, God decided to give me a little more energy today.
Wonderful. Yeah. I hope he keeps doing it.
Yeah, me too.
Okay.
See here, I didn't even need my gun. See ya, my friend. Oh. Oh my goodness, what a nice day.
Yeah, beautiful.
So I'm recovering from a colonoscopy on Friday.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, how was it?
Oh, the procedure's okay, but they put so much air in you that I had...
Oh, yes.
Oh, God.
Oh, they do.
Yeah. I've had pain, but that caused me to get sick to my stomach. But when you haven't eaten anything, there's nothing to throw up, right?
I had a... they put a lot of air in me when I had my gallbladder out.
Oh.
And that air goes up here and up here. It would blow your stomach
in your cavity?
Up.
Oh.
And does that ever hurt?
Yeah.
All day. And they make you get up out of bed and walk.
Why don't they take this air out? If they can put it in, they can...
Well, they do.
Have a little valve on the end of it and take it out.
They do, but... It doesn't all go...
No.
Well, sir... I suppose they'll probably have that, and the new bodies will be automated.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay, that's it.
Good to see ya.
A piano player is playing here, even he's playing hurt today. He wounded himself. And that's, we've heard these rumors about Rich retiring because he injured his shoulder. He was in Los Angeles a couple weeks ago. And he was with his sister and her two little kids. And they crossed the street. He was chasing a soccer ball. And he tripped on a crack in the street, and he fell. That hibiscus, the hibiscus in the upper right arpeggiator. Let's take a look at an MRI. They did an MRI of him here. They do. They did an MRI with a submarine, I believe. It's a little known medical procedure. And they did a CAT scan, too. You want to do that? shall we? Well, let's talk about looking at Paul. Let's take a video of that Paul. And here he's walking across with the two little kids chasing that soccer ball. And this is in Los Angeles, so that crack in the street, this is from an earthquake. You see, this is, it's about 14 feet long, it's about 60 feet deep. And here he trips and he falls. Down he goes. That's your hibiscus and the arpeggiator right there. And they took him to the hospital in an ambulance. Due to the budget shortfall in California, they put people into a wagon and they pull him behind a bike. And the bicyclist makes the siren sound himself. They're in the emergency room where he was treated by a veterinarian. Is doing our show today. He doesn't have a lot of strength in that right arm, right shoulder, so he can't do those big chords. So we brought in another pianist.
Keyboardist, yeah.
Candace Cantaloupe from the off Broadway production of Stomp, yeah. Stomp on It. Yeah. The one with fire and bare knuckle boxing and giant cockroaches. And so she's going to do those big chords. Are you okay to play today?
Yes, of course.
No, I'm talking
am.
To Rich.
Yeah, I'm fine.
You're fine, okay. You look uncomfortable there.
No, I'm okay.
Oh, he's okay. Let's go.
Okay, but, I mean, okay is not the same as fine. Okay, it's...
Well, I'm here. I came to play.
No, I know. What about these rumors about your retirement, though?
I don't believe that.
Oh, no? Okay, but you know, when you start falling down in the street, you know, maybe it's time to take it easy.
Well, you know, it's just an accident, huh?
Yeah, there's different kinds of accidents. There's a wonderful assisted living home for musicians. It's called the Dotted Rest.
No, let's just do that.
Huh?
I don't think so.
I mean, we don't want you to overexert
yourself. Yeah, let's just do the show. Don't pay any attention to me.
Slowski, playing with pain, doing the show today. Even though he's suffering. Maybe we should just do some slow ballads. Just some... What, Tom?
No, I think I can play a tune of mine called I'll Show You.
I'll Show You. Okay. Let's watch it here. Yeah.
See me walk. yard just to sing, and then he clapping my hands. Tell my mama I love her, tell my father I try, give my money to my baby to spend. But I'm going uptown to the Harlem River to drown. Dirty water's gonna cover me over, and I'm not gonna make a sound. Times come and they go, and even a good man will break. He'll let his troubles bury him whole, even though he knows what's at stake. So I'm taking no chances, I'm carrying over while I'm still good in his grace. And I know, ooh, mama, I know the difference between tempting and choosing my fate. But I'm going uptown to the Harlem River to drown. Dirty water's gonna cover me over, and I'm not gonna make a sound around.
Turn, turn.
successes, and they go to good schools and they get good jobs and they start families of their own and they're busy and you never see them again and you never get to know them, whereas the kids who are full of problems and who are sort of over and over in recovery are the ones you get to know, or the ones who want to be filmmakers and who come back and live with you for 5, 10, 15, 20, 35 years. And you get to know them. And you become close to them. They need you. And then eventually you need them. And they're the ones who are there at the end to hold your hand as you die. You're troubled children. You're problem children. This is the Christian irony, you see, that we contemplate during Lent is that in sadness and failure there is great comfort and great blessing, whereas in success there is great sadness and loss. This is a lesson that takes some people longer to learn. This is why Lutherans live as long as they do, because it takes them longer to learn the lessons that God wants us to learn on this earth.
Turn left on Benton Street.
Pastor Liz has laid down the law that the confirmation kids, all 11 of them, must come to Wednesday night Lenten services in the church or they will not be confirmed this spring. She's stuck to it, even though Mrs. Knudsen, the girls' volleyball coach up at the high school, complained bitterly about this. She's got a terrific team this year. Wednesday night is their big practice. But Pastor Liz said, no, 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 they have to come to Lenten services. These 11 kids, it's startling how ignorant they are of the basics of Scripture. You ask them, who is in the Trinity? And they have to think about it for a while. You give them a multiple choice test. Is it Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Is it Abraham, Martin, and John? Is it Tinkers and Evans and Chance? Father, Son, Holy Ghost? They think it's the last one, but they're not sure. Not for Pastor Liz to judge, only for her to teach. So she does. She teaches. She tells them stories, stories from the Bible and her own story. She told them the story on Wednesday night of her mother's green scarf that Liz coveted when she was a girl. It was so beautiful. It was a rich shade of green that came from some mysterious place. And there was sweet but pungent smells about it. And her mother wore it every Friday night. And her mother and her father went to a movie. Beautiful, laughing mother and cantankerous father. They went off on a date. This was her date scarf. Liz coveted this scarf, and she planned to steal it. And she took the scarf and she hid it up on the shelf amid other scarves and mittens, hoping that if it were missing for a month or two, her mother would forget about it, and then Liz could take it. And 3 weeks later, on her birthday, she opened the package from her mother, and there was the scarf rolled up. To be given something that you planned to steal.
Turn left on Pomeroy Avenue, entered right.
Liz thought it was sort of a parable of grace, but she wasn't sure, and she got interested in the story and she forgot what the moral of it was. She could only remember how much she loved this scarf and her mother putting it on around her neck, and her father, who was saw the scarf, and he would adjust it and tie it in a certain way, and they would go off to a movie together, laughing. Her father, who so seldom laughed. And so Liz came to associate the scarf with her own conception. This was the scarf that had led to her existence in the world. She got it as a gift from her wonderful, laughing...
Kitty. Thank you.
Thank you.